If he does not care for the little, he cares for nothing. Everything is so little to God, that if he does not care for the little, he cares for nothing. The psalm writer puts it in a different way. Psalm 36, verse 5 to 6, a Message translation, says the following. If we go to the next slide. God's love is so meteoric. His loyalty, astronomic. His purpose, titanic. His verdicts, oceanic. Yet in his largeness, nothing gets lost. Not a man, not a mouse slips through the cracks. It's hard for us to understand the scale and the vastness of God. I could have gone the other way and maybe looked at how small things can become as well. Go to the subatomic level. I chose, you know, to look at an illustration of how vast things are in terms of the universe itself. And as we could see from that clip, from what we know, as far as we can see, if we would have a laser beam or something like that from Earth, and we go like, bam, I want to reach the end of the universe. That's what I want to do tonight. All right? It better happen fast, because I've got programs to watch and church to go to and things to do. So I switch on my laser machine, and I go like, kazam. It will take more than 13.7 billion years to get to the other end. And I say more because, as far as we understand, the universe is actually still expanding. The vastness of things. And then the Bible says that God, he looks at the universe and he measures the expanse of the universe with the palm of his hand. The universe is not more than God, it's less than God. The vastness of God. But where does that leave us? And tonight, I actually want to say something very, very simple, and probably I'll make it complex again, but that's just my own fault, not because of anything else. But there's actually something very simple that I want to say. And it boils down to this. Eugene Peterson writes, and he says that the story of mankind, the story of humankind, perhaps we can say, is the story of us trying to hide from God. That is our story. That is the first act that Adam and Eve does before, you know, before they have to meet with God again after the fall of sin. They put fig leaves on a couple of spots, and they hide behind the bushes. Not a very effective way of hiding from God, you know, omniscient, one that creates a universe. And a couple of leaves is going to hide me away, yes. But I don't think we're any different. I think our history and our story of humankind is such a huge effort to hide away from God. It's not that God is not known. It's not that God cannot be seen. It's not that the character of God is not known. He makes every effort from his side to declare it. He comes in the flesh. He becomes man. He becomes Jesus Christ. He is Jesus Christ, not becomes. He is Jesus Christ. And yet our story is a story of trying to hide from God. Why? Why? I would say it's because we realize how vast this God is, and we realize how vast our external circumstances present itself to be. And because of that, we're often afraid. And we often try and keep God at a safe distance. Let me illustrate that to you. Very simple scripture, very well-known scripture. If we can go to Exodus 20, if we go to the next slide. Now, Exodus 20 describes the Ten Commandments. We all know the Ten Commandments. Again, I'm going to use a Message translation. Also, we understand the background of the Ten Commandments. The background is very simply this. The nation Israel is coming out of captivity. They were in captivity for about 400 years. 400 years is a long time. It is about as long as the modern history of South Africa. That's a while. 400 years, that's all that they've known, slavery. The ancestors, slaves. They did not know anything else. They did not experience anything else. They had no other expectations. And here comes this man, 80 years old, from a desert. A murderer. All right? You remember the story? He killed the Egyptian official before he fled into the desert. I mean, just imagine that for a moment. We've got to plant a church, and we go like, who are we going to send as a pastor to plant a church? Let's have some CVs. Let's have a look. Ooh, that might be a problem. This guy killed somebody. At least we know the tithes will be in on time. You know, no one is going to argue with him. I mean, when he does a bit of a visit, A home visit gives a whole different meaning to things, all right? No more problems. Everything's happened. I mean, the least expected person you'll find, a guy that's 80 years old, a guy that killed somebody, a guy that spent the last 40 years in the desert doing what? I mean, he was a hireling. He shepherded flock. He was not an important man. I mean, in our context, it would be somebody coming from Puff Adder that worked on a farm there looking after the sheep and the goats and the whatever grows there. 80 years old, killed somebody, and boom, this guy pitches up and he says, you know what, God has spoken to me, everything is going to be different. You go like, yeah, whatever. Whatever, dude. Get out of my way. And then something amazing happens, something miraculous happens, and it's just this once-off type of thing that God does. God seems to truly work with this man and through this man. And even this God is not very well known. I mean, Moses asks him, so who are you? And he goes, I am. So who's this God and who's this guy and what is happening here? But there's all kinds of weird stuff happening. And we're not talking about miracles that we sort of think afterwards, I've actually got a rational explanation for that one. No, we're talking about huge miracles happening. We're talking about the most powerful military machine of the time, the Egyptian army, that was suppressing millions of people. All right? We're talking about a lot of Israelites. And the miracles of God brings it to such a measure that the whole military machine of Egyptians fall to the wayside. They crumble. They become nothing. Isn't it always funny how people try and explain miracles and explain miracles away? I heard a very lacquer story about a guy that said, no, the Red Sea never happened. You know, the parting of the Red Sea, and they marched through it because he said, well, the point that they went through, in his estimation, actually, it's so flock. It's so shallow. Thank you for helping me. Your humility is my friend. It is so shallow that it cannot be parted. They just marched through it. And then an older lady stood up and she said, what a miracle. God drowned all of the Egyptian army in shallow water. That takes some doing. That takes some doing. All right, knee length and you under. Dead. All right. We're talking about huge miracles happening. And all this time, this man Moses is saying to the whole nation, listen, why God is doing this is only for one purpose. Not primarily for your freedom, although your freedom is a very important thing to him. It is primarily so that you may meet him and worship him. And that's where we're going. We're going to this place, Mount Sinai, and you're going to meet with this God. And this God is going to reveal himself to you. He's going to be glorious. And everything is leading up to there. And we're talking about a process of months and months leading up to this. Miracles and miracles. All right? So here they come to the mount. And here is this very important moment where they meet with God. Who is this God? Now, what is very interesting is that God reveals himself through the Ten Commandments as very righteous and very good. Is it not interesting that the Bible does not include a YouTube clip of what we just watched? The Bible doesn't talk. It does talk about the immensity of God, but it doesn't try and illustrate the immensity of God. How it really reveals and describes God is by his character. He is enthroned on righteousness and justice. And so God reveals himself through the Ten Commandments. Now, here's my expectation. This is my expectation. This is objectively what I think what would happen in a situation like this. I would think that these people sitting at the Mount Sinai, having a revelation of God, that they would be overwhelmed with joy. Why? Because not only is this God all-powerful, not only can this God destroy whatever he wants, but this God is truly good. Look at the Ten Commandments. So moral. So right. Let's read it. Let's go through it. It's not what I want to speak about tonight, but I'm going to start there anyway. I've got the mic, so I can do what I want tonight. God spoke all these words, verse 1. I am God, your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of a life of slavery. No other gods, only me. No carved gods of any size, shape, or form, of anything, whatever, whether of things that fly, walk, or swim. Don't bow down to them. Don't serve them, because I am God, your God, and I am a most jealous God, punishing the children of for any sins their parents pass on to them to the third, and yes, even the fourth generation of those who hate me. But I'm unswervingly loyal to the thousands who love me and keep my commandments. No using the name of God, your God, in curses or silly banter. God won't put up with irreverent use of his name. Observe on Sabbath day to keep it holy. Work 6 days and do everything you need to do, but the seventh day is the Sabbath to God, your God. Don't do any work, not you, not your son, nor your daughter, not your servant, not your maid, not your animals, not even the foreign guest visiting in your town. For in 6 days God made the heaven, earth, and sea, and everything in them. He rested on the seventh day. Therefore God blessed the Sabbath day. He set it apart as a holy day. Honor your father and mother so that you live a long time in the land that God your God is giving you. No murder, no adultery, no stealing, no lies about your neighbor, no lusting after your neighbor's house or wife or servant or maid or ox or donkey. Don't set your heart on anything that is your neighbor's. Now, this is my expectation up to this point. What I would have guessed in a situation like this, if I've never heard the story, if I've never come across this, and I've heard all that has happened up to this point, this is my expectation, that people would say God is truly amazing. Because not only is he immensely powerful, but look at his goodness. He is utterly righteous. He rules according to what is right. And that is so different from any of our expectations in the world. I mean, up to that point, how people understood gods to be, deities to be, was that the gods were virtually just like people. They were just much more powerful, but they were just as evil. They were jealous. They were vindictive. They were cruel. They could take you out at the moment. And all that you had to do was try and appease the gods. You had to give your sacrifice. You had to try and do certain things to try and keep this God happy, because this God is like me. He's just got way more powers than I do. And here comes this revelation of God. And this revelation essentially is that he is good. Why the Ten Commandments are so important, why morality is so important, because it reflects who God is. It reflects his very nature, his character of love and goodness. Now, here's my expectation that people would go, I am so glad I'm here. Not only do I serve an immensely powerful God, but I serve immensely good God. He is truly God. I'm so glad. I'm so glad that I'm here. Agreed? That's what you would think as well? Let's look at how people responded. Now, just after these words, verse 18, all the people experiencing the thunder and lightning, the trumpet blast and the smoking mountain were afraid. They pulled back and stood at a distance. They said to Moses, you speak to us and we'll listen. But don't have God speak to us or we'll die. Moses spoke to the people, don't be afraid. God has come to test you and instill a deep and reverent awe within you so that you won't sin. The people kept their distance while Moses approached the thick cloud where God was. I would dare to say that I don't think it's so much different today. And I don't think it's that much different today, because I think, and I'm speaking of my own heart and looking at my own heart of dealing with people through the years and seeing what they're concerned with and how they deal with things. I would say all of us, in the back of our minds, we try and keep God at a safe distance. Am I wrong? We try and keep God at a safe distance. Why? Why? Because we realize how small we are. And it's so hard. It's so hard when you deal with a God that is so immense, not to feel small, not to feel afraid. It's so hard that if you look at your circumstances, you look at the environment. I mean, we look at that YouTube clip and it's sort of weird, aquatic, sort of whale noises in the background. But you don't start thinking at a moment, ugh, I'm so small. Am I important at all? Do I feature at all? Is my life worth much? And so we become afraid. And when we're afraid, we try and keep things safe. Now, I'm not saying that you're sitting here and you are quaking your boots when you hear the name of God. I'm not saying you're sitting here and you're looking at your circumstances and you're quaking in your boots. But I would say that all of us, we try so hard to keep ourselves safe. And keeping ourselves safe often involves keeping a safe driving distance from God. So I'm following Christ, but let's keep the distance here. Let's not do too much. Let's not get too close. And therefore, what we do is we often appoint a Moses. You speak to God. We'll listen what you say. Isn't it weird how we love gurus? Right? We have Christian gurus today. We read their books. We listen to their sermons. God can speak to you. We'll listen to you. Never appoint a Moses. You know why I say that? Because that is not what Christ wants for us. What he wants for us is that we see him face to face. You know, at best, and I'm so thankful for every Christian leader out there doing tremendous work. I'm supportive of all of them. I bless all of them. They are important in my estimation, all of them. But at best, any one of us, from the least to the greatest of Christian leaders, all that we do is contribute and walk the road with you. We cannot walk the road on behalf of you. See, the Bible says there's only one mediator between God and man, Jesus Christ. Our lives is a life, our greatest adventure, our greatest journey, our greatest object in life is to know God. To know the great I am, to grow in our experience of him, to grow in our knowledge of him, to grow in our relationship with him, to grow in our love with him. That is life. And everything in life becomes a learning school unto that. Work is a learning school unto that. Marriage is a learning school. Kids, I presume, is a learning school. Everything in life is a learning school simply for this one thing. To get to know God more and more. He's truly one that fills everything in every way. I want to talk to you tonight about the Moseses. And obviously in this example, it was actually a person. I would say today, it's not mostly a person, it's mostly an attitude that we adopt. A Moses attitude, if I can put it that way. By which we keep a safe distance from God. Let me tell you, where's the best place to keep a safe distance from God? In church. That is the best place to keep a safe distance from God. You know why? Because I can pretend in church. I can't pretend out there. I must either repent or come back to God, or I must continue my rebellion. But in church, I can pretend. Church can become my Moses. Oh, I'm saying tough stuff tonight. Everyone's still all right. Everyone breathing. Everyone's looking at me. Life is good. All right. Now, before we look at the way that we keep safe distance from God, I want to say this, and this is very important. We must always keep in mind God is immensely powerful. God is immensely good. And we should never put caps on any of that. All right? When in our minds God is not powerful, he cannot do things, we lose our idea of who God really is. In our minds, if we cap how good God is, it might be immensely powerful, but how good he is, after a while we lose sight of who God really is. As we proceed, keep this in mind. God is immensely good. God is immensely powerful. All right? And life is a journey of discovering exactly how good and exactly how powerful he is. Now, I would like to take you to the New Testament for a moment. And just in sort of broad strokes, I'd like to describe to you what was the two major problems in the New Testament church. And I'm going to take that approach because I'm going to use that to describe to you how we often keep safe distances from God as believers. As believers. All right. Now, broadly speaking, the New Testament church faced two problems. The one problem was legalism. The other problem was Gnosticism. Have you heard the word Gnosticism before? Hands up if you had heard the word Gnosticism before. Right. Good stuff. I feel happy. All right. Let me just say this. If you read the New Testament, you realize that the first century church was not perfect. All right. Book of Corinthians. You read it, you go like, yeah, that's a weird church. Okay, look at the stuff they do. All right. Freaky. And I'm not talking about spiritual gifts. I'm talking about that section in the middle. of the book of Corinthians, if you're catching my drift. Go and read it. You know what I mean, if you've read it. The first church was not perfect. All right, we must get over this thing of saying, if we can just become like the first century church. Because the first century church was not perfect. It was full of nonsense. But it was life-giving. And it grew and was close to God. And in the same way, we should get rid of this idea of a perfect church. It does not exist because the church is filled with you and me. But we can be life-giving. We can be alive, we can be well, and we can be life-giving because of the grace of God. And that is what we should aim for. But now, in general, two issues faced the first century church. And interesting enough, these two issues were issues of deception. I would say the biggest problem we often face is not temptation or accusation, condemnation, is not demonic oppression. I would say deception is the biggest issue we often face. You know why? Because deception is like invisible prison. You put yourself in there, and you can't even see it, and your life becomes very small because of it. Deception is particularly tricky. You know, if you're deceived, you don't know you're deceived. Everyone goes like, dude, really, that is wrong. You're deceived. And you go like, no, I am not deceived. The cheetahs will win the Super 15. I am not deceived at all. You all deceived. All right? Isn't it funny what perception, a different word I can use for it is perception. How we see certain things and you talk to somebody, you go like, dude, I wish I could smack you so hard that that idea just jumps out of the other ear when I've done that. Don't do that. But, you know, it's just like, I can't believe you actually think that. And that's an interesting thing about deception. You put yourself virtually in that position. So what are the two major broad strokes, deceptions that the early church struggled with? The one is legalism. If we go to the next slide, John Doe. And then the other one, let's keep it there, legalism. Now, when I say legalism today, most of us think about a person that is morally exceptionally strict. You know, this sort of attitude in life. All right? Unbending, moral, but not really loving. All right, that's how we think of legalism today. Am I right? More or less? Ballpark, sort of? What did they understand then? This is what happened. Paul, Book of Galatians is a very good example of legalism. Paul, in his missionary trips, he would follow the same pattern. He would go into a town and would first go to the synagogue and he'll preach to the Jewish people and then he'll kick him out. Cheers. All right? He always followed this pattern. He's a guy that never learned. And the thing is, he was actually seen as an apostle to the Gentiles. He describes himself as an apostle to the Gentiles. And the first thing he always does is go to the synagogue and preach to the Jewish guys. And they're like, cheers. And then he'll go to the Gentiles, he'd preach to the Gentiles, and they'll get saved. Boom, right there. All right? And then he'll go like, okay, you're the pastor, you're the elder, you're the deacon, go for it, I'm leaving. And then he goes to the next town, and that church stands, and they go. It freaks me out, I must be honest, but it happened. All right? And then he goes on, and then he does the same thing. And wherever he goes, there's churches that is left among the Gentiles. Now, there was a group of people that followed Paul from town to town when he left the town. They were called Judaizers. Judaizers. And what they would do is the following. They'll go to the Gentiles that just became a church, that just followed Christ, and they would say to them, listen, it is all great. You're saved. Well done. Here's a certificate. That's amazing. We're so grateful. We're so glad. But now, it's not enough. You must now embrace a certain culture. All right? Now, to be honest, throughout the history of Christianity, that's where people get hurt the most, when the gospel is reduced to a certain culture. And the culture normally has got very little to do with Christ and the fullness of Christ. In other words, you start embracing outward form. And you can go and read the book of Galatians. Paul goes ape. He goes ape. He calls his group of men dogs. All right? He was not happy. He was not smiling. He was not pulling a emoticon next to that. He was like, you know, he was fuming. I'm going to, you know, I can see him writing. He's angry. He calls them mutilators of the flesh. He is furious. Why? Because they've reduced a living relationship with God to an outward form. Now, how does it apply to us today? I don't think anyone is tempted to do circumcision. No one is tempted. No problem. We don't have any issues here. That's all good. All right. No mutilators of the flesh. That's all good. That's all good. But how do we do it? We embrace an outward form of Christianity. I do all the right things. I tick the boxes. I come to church. I go to small group. Now, those things are good. Please go to come to church. Go to small group. Do that. But I tick all the boxes. And I have the outward appearance, but I lose in the process the living relationship. And that's why legalism is so difficult to catch, because you're doing all the right things. And doing the right things, well, after all, it's really important. That's a catch. Doing the right things is important. So we do it, but the reason why we do it is wrong. And often, here's the thing. The reason why we fall into legalism is because we are afraid of God. We're afraid of God, and if I can just do the right things, my head will not stick out. God will not get me, and I will be okay. You know where that often crops up, that issue crops up the easiest, is with evangelism. I must do it. I must do it. Now I've got a chat with you. I don't have a clue who you are. I don't love you. So when you die, where are you going? All right? And it's like, oh, I don't know. I don't know. Who's this dude? I'm just trying to eat my McDonald's. What are you doing to me? All right? And we walk away. Check. Sir. Great. Great. All right? Now, to be honest, in a theological framework, evangelism, whether it happens from wrong motives or the right motives, it's all blessed. Only problem is it's not blessed to you, really. And it might not be that blessed to the person receiving it, because here's a problem. If you do things to check a box because I'm afraid that God is going to get me, you're always going to keep a safe distance from God. And therefore, your relationship with God will be reduced to an outward form. But denying the power thereof. And you know, anything can be turned into an outward form. Speaking in tongues can be turned into an outward form. Worship. Hands up, hands down. Sit up, down, kneel, up. All of it can be turned into outward form, and that's why legalism is so insidious. But legalism is actually easy to pick up because it's driven by fear. And most of the times, in my experience, that's just my opinion, it's driven by a fear that God is out to get me. I am not good enough. It's another way of putting it. I'm not good enough. God is going to get me. I'm not good enough. And that fear has got some solid basis to it, because here's a problem. God is perfect and I'm not. So yes, I do understand where that sentiment is coming from. It is very logical. But here's the thing. It does not factor in Christ and the perfect work of Christ. And that's why Paul was infuriated by the dogs and the mutilators of the flesh, because they've taken the best news ever. I can enter the presence of God and not die. That's the best news ever. And they've made it purely ritual. All right. Legalism. Some of the stages in your life, you're going to be in a position of legalism. All right? Think back. Think now. Are you going through the motions? Are you going through the motions? The second problem is a problem of Gnosticism. Let's go there. Gnosticism is a Greek word. So the Judaizers were people that struggled with the implications of the gospel. For the Jewish people, Gnosticism were people that struggled with the implications of the gospel for Greek people. Now, Greek people loved fancy arguments. They loved to look at something in depth. They always wanted to know more. They always thought something must be profound before it can be true. It cannot just be simple. And therefore, they often despised the gospel, yet they were intrigued by it. And Gnosticism simply comes from the Greek word gnosis, means knowledge. All right, how did this work? The book of Colossians is a very good example of a letter written against the problem of Gnosticism. Go and read the book of Colossians. So here's how Gnosticism works. Plato, one of the great Greek philosophers, said, you know what? We must explain this world that it is material and hence evil because it's material, but there must be a perfect spiritual world. So there's a perfect spiritual world that is good, and there's a material world that is evil. By the way, that is very much against the grain of Christianity because God becomes flesh. God doesn't have a problem with the material world. He redeems it. He creates it in his image. But in the Greek thought, the spiritual world is good. The material world is terrible. Somebody once wrote and said, in churches today, there is up to 75% of churches still follow some form of Gnosticism, whether they believe it or not. Let me give you the easiest way of knowing that you've got Gnosticism. Gnosticism becomes a reality. All right. Maybe let me give a bit more details before I drop the hammer. So Gnosticism is secret knowledge. How do I access this perfect spiritual world? By having secret knowledge. All right, so I've got spiritual knowledge and boom, I'm in good standing with God. Only problem is the secret knowledge becomes so secret that it becomes more secret. Then it becomes more weird. And then it becomes more fringe. And then pretty soon I look around me and I realize I am irrelevant to the world around me. I would say most churches struggle with Gnosticism, not because they're great fans of Plato, but because we try so hard to avoid the world out there. It's called a Christian clique. It's a thing we do when we go to a finance hall. You know what happens to a small group? Let me drop ammo. You know what happens to a small group if a small group is together for more than a year? They start getting weird. Because what do we talk about tonight? Oh, I don't know. We've talked about that. We spoke about this. Let's look at the seventh heaven experience. Right? Now, I'm not saying that there's a place that we cannot know more of God and more of the kingdom of God. There's always a place we can know more. There's always a place where we can go deeper. But yet, we look at Christ, and Christ was the one that was always applicable to circumstances. He's the one that could make the message of a kingdom so simple that a child, a prostitute, a leper, a rich young man, anyone could understand it because he was always relevant to the needs around him. And that's why I do truly believe that the gospel is a simple gospel. And we try and make it strange and weird sometimes because we feel that if I've got a grip on a recipe, and there's the second golden word of Gnosticism, a recipe. If I've got a recipe down, then God has got no choice but to do what I want him to do. Listen, there's a lot of recipes flowing around, and it's getting weirder and weirder. Now, I just want to say, we're sitting in a westernized Christianity currently, which means that our Christianity is product-based. All right? Everyone knows what I'm talking about? Which means every couple of years, a new Christian product is going to come on the market. And it's going to be a method. And it's going to be a recipe. And why have you not done the recipe? What's wrong with you? And then you do the recipe. All right? Now I've done the recipe. And worst of all, we do the recipe on God. So I've got a need. Life suddenly knocks on my door, and I do the recipe on God, and then God better performs because I've got the recipe. Here it is. All right? Only problem is this. God is not so much into recipes because he's not a chocolate cake. He's not a chocolate cake. God is not an object. He's a person. Isn't it weird? Isn't it weird? Let me give you another analogy of this, another example of this. Let's talk about marriage. Let's talk about husband and wife, all right? That's what everyone can understand. Even if you're not married yet, you can understand what I'm saying. Now, If we approach it from a legalist point of view, it's about getting all the outward appearances right. I watched a comedy stand-up session by Trevor Noah the other night. I nearly got a hernia on stage. He was speaking about white people in South Africa, how they never want to be shamed in public. So they've got this ventriloquist thing that if a couple fights in public, you can never hear where it's coming from. You know, outward appearance. We must always look fine. So you're fighting in the aisle. And then somebody from church comes by and you go like, hello, no, I'm so blessed. Everything is fine. Every person walks past again, you go, you know, I don't do it as well as he did, but I nearly died laughing. You know, outward appearance. But imagine you're stuck in a marriage where it's all about just doing the right things. You bring the flowers, you do the dishes, you do the food, you clean the house, but you never look one another in the eye and say, I truly love you. Now, the house might be very clean always, but who wants to be in a marriage like that? Am I right? Then why do we do that to God? Why do we do that to God if we don't even want to do that to one another? Let's look from the Gnosticism point of view, the recipe point of view. Recipes, methods. So you open the Sari or the Landbou Weekblad, or whatever you open, Farmers Weekly. All right. How to get your wife, how to get your spouse, your husband to say yes to your demands. You go like, whoa, this is for me. I'm going to read this. Step A, wow, I never thought of this. Step B, man, you are showing me the keys. Yeah, I'm sorted. Only problem is you come with your recipe, you start with point A, and your wife is already onto you. She already knows. All right, she read the same article or something like that. Because no one wants to feel like they're being manipulated into something. And that's a problem with recipes. And here's the thing about our relationship with God. We will never get rid of good old face-to-face time with God. We'll never get rid of wrestling with an angel like Jacob did. We'll never get rid of Job sitting there when he's lost everything and his friends come to him and say, dude, seriously, cough it up. His friends were into recipes, obviously. Because his friends went like, dude, we discern you. Your wife has told you to curse God and die. Oh, you're never doing marriage prep, presenting marriage prep again, ever. All right? Not in our congregation. You know? We've discerned you. I mean, look at what's happening. You've lost everything. Obviously, there's sin in your life. Obviously, you've broken the recipe. Dude, don't you know? If you don't do the recipe right for chocolate cake, it's flat. All right? We know that. So dude, cough it up. And he goes like, I didn't do it. No. Let's let him steam a bit. All right? We'll keep him on the ash heap. We're not bringing him any sandwiches, nothing. No coke, nothing. Let him steam a bit. I will come back later again and go like, dude, cough it up. His friends went to recipes. And here's the thing, God never tells Job why. What happened to him? What happened? In the end of the day, what Job had was good face-to-face time of God and was immense. It was immense. I've heard, but now I've seen. And then God does something tremendous in his life. Now, our God is not that small that we can manipulate him with a method. Right? I'm very skeptical. If people start talking about methods, I'm very skeptical. If people start talking about the new and the best, then I go like, no, my friend. It's nothing new under the sun. It's only Christ. Because most of the times, it's excuse for not having face-to-face time with God. And it's exceptionally difficult to have face-to-face time with God. Because he doesn't keep a schedule. He doesn't go, 5 minutes, I'm going to give you the answer. Because we have to watch an Mnet movie now. He doesn't do that. Right? He doesn't do, I've got to give you a great explanation or else you're going to unfriend me on Facebook. He doesn't do that. God cannot be cornered in any way. But we can approach Him boldly. Because of grace, because of Christ, we can walk into the throne room of God to obtain strength and mercy in the time of need. But then that is what we should do. You see, at the end of the day, it does all boil down to relationship. And with relationship, what is needed with relationship is face to face, eye to eye. Now, I haven't got it on there, but I'd just like to show you that first verse that I read about God's love. I'm just going to read it again. I haven't got it on the presentation, and then just go on to the next couple of verses, and maybe we can all stand tonight and just bring ourselves before God. Verse 5 says, God's love is meteoric, His loyalty astronomic, His purpose titanic, His verdicts oceanic. Yet in His largeness, nothing gets lost. Not a man, not a mouse slips through the cracks. How exquisite Your love, O God. How eager we are to run under Your wings, to eat our fill at the banquet You spread, as You fill our tankards with Eden spring water. You're a fountain of cascading light, and You open our eyes to the light. Let's close our eyes and let's focus on God. Tonight, it's not about the person next to you. It's not about me. It's about you and God. And let's bring ourselves before God tonight. Now, I just want to go back to what Fred shared in the beginning. Some of you, you're not even keeping a safe distance from God. You're not following Him at all. And tonight we would love to pray with you. What we're going to do tonight is just open the area in front here. We're going to pray for one another. That is one of the ways in which we love and care for one another, is to pray for one another. So tonight, if you have a need in this regard, we're going to pray with you. Perhaps tonight you realize, like I said, you've never followed God, and tonight you need to make that decision to follow God. Equally, there's two groups of people here tonight that I would just love to pray with, we would love to pray with. And the first group of people, you're struggling with legalism. You're struggling with legalism because you're afraid that God does not find you acceptable in any way or form. And you're trying so hard to do all the right things, but in the end of the day, your heart becomes hardened. Your heart becomes hardened because in an effort to keep your world safe from God, your walls just get thicker and thicker. That's what we do if we try and keep ourselves safe. We make our walls thicker, we make our walls higher, and what is meant to keep out, after a while, keep us in. And you're struggling with legalism. You're struggling with outward form. You're doing worship, but you're not feeling like it at all. You're doing church, you're doing small group, but you don't want to be there. You want to read the Bible, but you actually don't want to read the Bible at all. Because it's not about the relationship with God anymore. It's about trying to keep a safe distance. Trying to keep a safe distance. And it's not that you're backslidden. It's not like you're walking away from God. But it's not like you're close to God either. And after a while, then things become meaningless to you. And that's where people really get taken out. Because at the end of the day, it is about the relationship. Then there's the second group of people, and that's if you struggle with narcissism, typically what happens with you is you're always going from event to event. You're always going from one guru to the next guru, one speaker to the next speaker, one method of Christianity, method of being spiritual, method of getting closer to God that is being advertised, that your friends follow and you follow with. And you know what? I don't have a problem with methods, except that when we start using methods to control God and we start jumping from place to place, but we never truly actually connect with God Himself in the secret place. I think for all of us, perhaps if I can summarize both groups, if we truly struggle to switch off a television, to switch off a radio, to not be everywhere with every possible friend for fear of missing out, and actually just spend face-to-face time with God. What happened here? Why did this happen? If you never have dialogue with God, you know, prayer is not a monologue. It's not you updating God on what is. He knows perfectly what is, better than we do. It's dialogue. It's God speaking to us and we respond. It is listening and speaking. Not just speaking, it's listening as well. And if you're in that position, not hearing God, and you struggle therefore speaking to God, then tonight we just love to pray for you. I really just feel that the time of keeping a safe distance from God, it's over. It's over, because the problem is, in our estimation of keeping a safe distance from God, pretty soon we can find ourselves having lost sight of God. You know, like you're following a car and it's at night in you. Because this world often is dark. And you're following this car and it's at night, and this car is just much quicker than you are, and the next thing you see, you can't see this car anymore. I'm sure it's happened to many of you. You're friends, you're going with friends to a place, you don't know where it is, and they just say, just follow us. And if you don't stick close enough, pretty soon what happens, you get lost in the traffic. Therefore, I really feel tonight it's important that we make this commitment, that we say, you know what, I don't want outward appearance. I don't want my fear of my external circumstances. I don't want my fear of God to keep me away from God anymore. I want to be close. I want to be close. I want to be like a Moses. And you know, the truth is, Moses shows us no one is disqualified. You can be 80, I don't think you can be an ex-murderer. You can be 80, you can be a murderer, you can be a shepherd in Pofadder. You can be wherever, and nothing disqualifies you from coming closer to God. God himself says that he speaks to the prophet, but with Moses it's different. He speaks to him face to face like a friend. You can be a friend of God. And friendship has got everything to do with intimacy, proximity, coming close, not keeping the safe distance, not reducing God to outward form, not reducing God to a recipe. Here's the thing, your recipe is going to fail because God is not a recipe. Here's the thing, your outward form is going to crumble because God is into the reality of things, not the outward appearance of things. So if that's you tonight, and you truly want the reality, we're going to ask the rest of the worship band to come to the front, and we're going to sing a worship song together. And as I'm doing that, I want to ask you to come to the front so we can pray for one another. Amen.